to Cooler Than Homework, a Disney Channel original movie podcast. I'm Nicole Sweeney, and my best bowling score, I don't know it, but I'm very bad at bowling, so like low one, a little over 100 probably.
I'm Matthew Gatos, and my bowling high score is 233.
Nice. Yeah, like half of that is probably my best one.
My name is Maninis, and my bowling high score is probably also like 110.
And I'm Sari Riley, and my bowling high score is probably like 150 or 160. I went a lot as a kid because that and roller skating were the only two things people did, apparently.
And we are sharing this information with you because this week we are talking about Alley Cat Strike. And to tell us what happened in this movie, it was sadly not the rival gangs of dumpster diving kids. Yeah. Yes. Instead, Mari, what was the actual plot of this movie?
As soon as we finished recording and we were still on the call, we all went, Sari, Allie, bowling. Alas, this is a sports movie DCOM, and it is about the neighboring towns of East and West Appleton, and the high schools in those towns participate in a sort of like sports tournament where the winner wins a trophy called the Mighty Apple. In the coming year, however, the two schools are going to become one giant high school, meaning that this is the last year of the Mighty Apple, and whoever wins it forever. The mayors of the two towns are super competitive, so they really want to win. In the last game that they play, West Appleton wins the basketball game, but this actually results in a tie in the tournament overall. And the tiebreaker is basically some other sport, with the only requirement being that it must be a team or club that already exists at both schools, and no new team members can sign up. So East Appleton picks the sport, and it turns out to be bowling. So West Appleton's bowling team is a group of best friends, a bunch of unpopular cool cats who like bowling and diners and swing music and dressing in bowling shirts. They also find out that the school's star player in like every other sport, the very popular Todd McLemore, was signed up for the bowling team as a prank at the beginning of the year by some of the other popular kids, which means that he gets to play on the bowling team, and everybody's like, great, he's going to lead us to victory. But like, Todd can't actually bowl, and so that's a problem. But also the Alley Cats, they aren't super competitive, so they're taking this like really calmly, so they have to help each other along the way. That's kind of the bulk of the movie. It's rough at first, and then, but you know, things get better between Todd and Alex, who's the other main character. But the more time that Alex spends with Todd, the more he starts acting like a popular kid, upsetting his original best friends. The kids all also join in on a plan to help save the dying bowling alley, which is owned by Alex's father. So they throw this big event, and at the event, Alex overhears some of the cool kids complaining about having to hang out with him, and they're basically like, once the Mighty Apple thing is over, we don't have to hang out with him anymore. And obviously this hurts Alex's feelings. He's in general just like really upset about how his new friends aren't really his friends and his old friends are mad at him. And then he like I think the cherry on top is that the mayor comes over with like ugly uniforms. They really are some ugly t-shirts. So he's like, and we gotta wear the ugly t-shirts. So he quits the team. Todd ends up visiting Alex and giving him like a pep talk, also revealing their new cooler bowling shirts, and it's got like an alley cat on the back and fake names on the front. And after Todd leaves, then his dad comes out and gives him a pep talk and reveals that he was best friends with Todd's dad, the now mayor, and they were on the baseball team together. They lost a game and then eventually lost the Mighty Apple that year. So that created a huge rift in their friendship. And his advice is basically like, have fun. Don't let this ruin your relationships. So the day of the game, Alex decides to join back on the team, and then we watch the final like montage of the competition, and they end up behind, But if Todd, who's the last bowler, can bowl a spare or a strike, they win. So Todd bowls his last ball. I don't know what you say there. Like, I don't know if that's how you verb that correctly. But that's what I said. And he ends up with a 7-10 split. So he had practiced. He had tried to, like, get the 7-10 split in a spare, and he never was able to master it. So everybody's like, oh, no, the West has lost. But then the quietest member and the one who is serving as kind of like the spare member of the team speaks up, Delia, and she says that she can do this. She is kind of like a math and, I don't know, physics whiz or something. So she says that she can definitely get the 7-10 split. So they sub her out at the last minute. Everyone's really upset because Todd's like the star, but he has learned the valuable lesson of how to take a step back and let Delia do her thing. So she rolls like the ball spinning. She like spins it. You should see me making hand motions. Like, you can see me. The ball is spinning and moving really slowly, and everybody watches it. And then so when it hits the, I guess, like the 7 ball, it causes the pin to also spin, and then it knocks down the 10, giving her the spare, and Wes Appleton wins. And then Todd basically tells his dad that he just had fun and he should chill out and probably not name the school West Appleton, because then he just kind of like erases the identity of a whole other half of the town. And so Alex suggests that they name it Appleton Central, and everybody is happy and they dance and have fun. The end.
So, Matt, where is the cast of this movie now?
They're everywhere. Everyone pretty much in this movie, most of them, very still popular and acting. So good on you, cast of Alley Cat Strike. First up, we're going to talk about Matt McCoy, who plays Alex's dad in this movie. He's one of those guys who I saw him and was just like, hey, it's that guy who's in stuff that I think I've seen. And it turns out that's true, because he's been on Seinfeld. He was in the Mary-Kate and Ashley movie Passport to Paris. Ooh. He plays the dad in that. But what I think I actually recognized him from is from an episode of The West Wing, which makes more sense because I watched that more times than Passport to Paris.
But Passport to Paris was an important film. Let's not sell that role short.
I was more of a Billboard dad kid than a Passport to Paris kid. So.
Yeah, that's true. Same, actually. Yes.
This is the second podcast I've been on that has brought up Billboard Dad, and it still sounds fake every time someone says it. It's just like, oh, you know that good old movie Billboard Dad?
Don't worry, Sari. After we move on to Smugrats, after that, we're doing our Mary-Kate and Ashley podcast. And then you'll watch, man, Billboard Dad.
Good. Can't wait.
I am excited for that. Next up, we have Todd's dad, played by Tim Reed, who I know best as the dad from Sister Sister, but you might also know him from That 70s Show or the old It miniseries, like the original Stephen King It adaptation. But more recently, he's continued to act, and in the past few years has been in a Lifetime Christmas movie, a Hallmark Christmas movie, an OWN channel Christmas movie, and a Christmas movie on the Up TV channel, which I actually watched this movie. It was called like Rooftop Christmas Tree. I watched that when I was at home this Christmas break with my mom, which is also when I learned that Up TV was a channel that exists. Yeah, I was wondering, I assume, sorry, Sari, that you don't know this man, but I was wondering for the other two of you, where you recognize him from the most.
Sister, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Last fun fact about Tim Reed is that in real life, he has been married since 1982 to Daphne Reed, who plays Todd's mom in this movie. So they are a real life married couple, which I never knew until researching for this episode.
That's great.
I love it.
Yeah. And Daphne Reed is most recognizable as the second Aunt Viv from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And she has continued acting off and on since Alley Cat Strike, but not a lot. She was, however, just in the Oscar-nominated movie Harriet about Harriet Tubman. I don't know who she plays. She wasn't in the trailer, and I haven't seen the film yet. So I don't know who she plays, but she's in it.
Oh, my God. She was also in Cagney and Lacey.
Oh, wow.
Hey.
I don't know. It could have been one episode. I'm literally just like scrolling on Wikipedia because I wanted to put a face to a name. And yeah, it says Cagney and Lacey, which are now two names I know belong together thanks to this podcast.
Yeah. Look out for our fourth upcoming podcast, our Cagney and Lacey episode by episode rewatch. Or I guess watch for the first time.
Yeah, first watch.
Yeah. During the plot synopsis, the quietest member of the group, Delia, was brought up because in some sort of bowling loophole, I guess you can just sub people in mid-bowl. I don't know. That felt like a rule break to me. But Delia is played by Mimi Paley, who hasn't been in a ton of things. She acts here and there. There was like a couple like recent sort of like horror short films that I saw that she has been in. But before Alley Cat Strike, she played Little Buffy in an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, as well as appearing in some episodes of Malcolm in the Middle, The X-Files, and Entourage. She doesn't seem to be acting much beyond those couple of shorts. And like a lot of ex-DCOM stars, my research involves going to their Instagram and seeing how their life is going. And according to her Instagram, she seems to be living a nice, happy, normal life, which is, you know, the best outcome we can hope for. All right. I think the next one's like the elephant in the room as far as like what this cast is doing now. And playing Elisa Bowers in this film is Kaylee Cuoco, who obviously is the most famous person because of The Big Bang Theory.
Sari.
I did recognize her. I saw.
Hey. Yeah.
I didn't throughout the movie. And I was like, that blonde girl looks vaguely familiar, but maybe she just looks like a blonde girl. Mm-hmm. And I've seen plenty of those. But then in the credits, it was Kaylee Cuoco. I was like, I've seen that name somewhere. And then I had to think for a little bit. And then Big Bang Theory.
But you at least got there.
Yeah, that's like two out of all these movies so far. The guy in Parks and Rec who was in
in the background
and then now Kaylee Cuoco.
That's
so
wild.
I can like kind of see after that I like looked up her character and I like can see the resemblance, how that child would grow up into that adult, but I still don't know if I would have seen it on my own without reading the credits.
She looks exactly the same. Literally. The same face.
It's also very clear to me now that Sari never watched Eight Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, which she was also in, correct, in sort of the midpoint between Alley Cat Strike and Big Bang Theory.
And that is like actually like a good, fun, I don't know, family sitcom. That like Big Bang Theory, fuck that show. But Eight Simple Rules was good. I liked Eight Simple Rules.
Yeah, it had Smart House's Katie Seagal.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, Kaylee Cuoco, obviously, Big Bang Theory, one of the like highest paid actors around these days on TV. But between Alley Cat Strike and this, she was not only on Eight Simple Rules, but also on some episodes of Charmed. And most recently, she is now the voice of Harley Quinn on the new like R-rated Harley Quinn animated series that they're doing on the DC Universe streaming platform. Getting to our main two stars in this, getting to our main two stars of the film, we have Alex, played by Kyle Schmid. You might recognize him, maybe, from Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants or another DCOM that we'll be talking about at a later date. But he is still acting in a bunch of shows that I've heard of but never watched, like Being Human and Copper. I have not seen Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, so I don't know if he's like a main character or if he's just like a friend of a friend in the film. Has anyone seen that and can vouch for his role?
I have seen it, but so long ago that I have no recollection.
I have also seen it a bunch of times, but also so long ago, but he doesn't strike me as a main character. But I could be totally wrong.
I mean, I'm guessing he's not in the Sisterhood, so he's probably just a side character.
That is correct.
But yeah, I also have not seen Being Human or Copper, so I don't know this man. But he does fall into the recurring category that comes up on this podcast of DCOM hot dads on Instagram. And if you go check out his Instagram, he posts lots of pictures of himself shirtless and just being attractive, either like with his cute daughter or his dogs. And so, you know, not a bad follow if that's what you're looking for. But the beefy Instagram does not stop with Kyle Schmid, because next we have playing Todd McLemore, Robert Richard, who you might know from a lot of things like Cousin Skeeter, House of Wax, Veronica Mars, The Vampire Diaries, Coach Carter. lots of things. I don't know if this man looked familiar to you. He looked familiar to me, but I could not place what I knew him from. And I think it was Cousin Skeeter.
Yeah, I definitely, I mean, I recognized him, but also like I watched this movie a lot. So that was one, but I also was aware of like him existing in other things like Veronica Mars. I just know his face. It's very distinct.
Yeah, he's very recognizable.
He is one of those people that I'm like, I have definitely seen you in a ton of things. Like, picking what exactly is like a little bit trickier, especially because his Veronica Mars arc was part of the end of the third season. So like, meh.
On top of still acting some, he is also a fitness instructor, as well as a CEO of EPM, which is an herbal healing supplement thing company. I don't know. I tried to like find some science on their website and I struggled. They used the word medicine, but spelled instead of a C in medicine, it's with a X, like medicine.
Oh, no.
Yeah, there's a quote that says EPM continually crafts medicine prepared with the Bible's most potent healing ingredients that deeply attune muscles and decrease inflammation.
I hate this.
I do too.
Yeah.
I'm so upset.
But whatever it is, it's working because he looks great. But that, no. He was recently.
That, no, we can't say that.
We cannot endorse medicine.
I'm definitely not endorsing the medicine, but I think he maybe falls into the sort of. I don't want to speculate, but like the guy who was already ripped and good looking starts like a healthcare company that like maybe doesn't make you look like him. In the end,
this is like the second most upsetting outcome. Like, first is obviously when an actor has passed away, but second is biblical medicine for sure.
Yeah. It's like death and then MLM. But if you want to avoid the medicine section of his life, you can watch a couple movies that he was in recently. One called Chocolate City, the second one called Chocolate City 2, Vegas, that seemed to be very Magic Mike inspired, if not straight ripoffs.
Okay.
So yeah, if you're looking for another attractive DCOM man to follow on Instagram, which is basically what my explore page is at this point because I keep looking up these people, check out Robert Richard.
Former child stars who have now gotten ripped.
Yep.
That's great. That's a really good way to mess with the algorithm.
Yeah. If you want to know where this cast is now, they're on my Instagram explore page.
Nostalgia check. Do you remember watching this prior to watching it for this podcast?
Nope. I do not.
Yes. This movie taught me what a 7-10 split was.
I also remember watching it, but in like this very hazy sort of way that like there were lots of things watching it this time that I didn't necessarily know were going to happen. Like I didn't always know exactly what was coming next, but there would be these random moments that was like, oh yes, I remember everything about this very specific scene or moment in the movie. But yes, I definitely watched this movie.
Oh, and no. I'll deliver that better. I like thought about it for a second and then realized I didn't need to think about it. No, I've never seen this movie before.
Your guess last week was a solid indicator of that.
Yeah.
This was not Newsies 2.
It was maybe your most wrong guess yet, I think.
You started with like rival something or others and I was like, okay, but that was like all the right. Only moment that
and then that was it. Then it was all over
downhill.
Yeah, I really just strayed from I picked the wrong alley cat, and once you pick the wrong thing.
There is a moment in this movie where Alex says something about not fighting like cats and dogs, and I cheered a little bit for Team Mangy Dog.
Yeah, their team names were the Alley Cats and like the Wolf Pack or something like that. Uh-huh. And I was like, okay, I got maybe the names.
What is a wolf if not a mangy dog? That's all I'm saying.
But I'm getting ahead of myself. Did you guys like this movie?
Yeah, sure. I thought it. Yes, I did. It's not going to be one of my favorite DCOMs. I think it's going to be pretty middling. Middle of the pack, maybe starting like the third tier of my bottom movies, but definitely better than all of those bottom movies. Like I'd watch this over and over all day long over like You Lucky Dog or Under Rocks or Can of Worms. So it's definitely not there for me, but yeah, it was just okay. Even when trying to like recap it, I realized that like there wasn't a lot of anything in the middle of the movie. So I don't know. I just don't think it will be memorable. But I remember really liking this when I was a kid. I think probably because something about like the uncool counterculturist group of friends with the hot little Alex kid in the lead. And then Todd over here also looking mighty fine to my child eyes. Some combination of all of that made it live good well for me as a child, but like looking back on it now, I'm just like, okay, that was a sports DCOM.
Yep.
Yeah, and it wasn't bad. Like, I did not dislike it, but I totally agree that it sort of is in that sort of like bottom third, like top of the bottom third of my favorite DCOMs so far that we've watched, because it's not offensive to me in any way. I don't hate it. I would watch it again. But when I started looking at like what we've watched, so many other things I enjoyed watching more than this. And again, not because it's bad, but just because it's kind of nothing. And there's a lot less charm and chemistry in this one than there is in a lot of other DCOMs. Like, I wrote in my notes, very few notes while I was watching, but my first one was, these kids don't exist. Like, these kinds of kids just... they don't exist. They're not real characters to me. And then also, because the chemistry was so off, I wrote, I can't tell if everyone's flirting or if no one is flirting. Because even like Alex and Todd, there's like moments where like they flirt and I can't tell, like, they have more chemistry than like the girls on the team. And I'm like, wait, is there like romance brewing with any of these people? And then I was like, oh, wait, no, I think they're just all really awkward kids.
Yeah. Even now that the movie is over, I still can't tell you the answer to that question.
I don't have anything really original to say, but yes, I ranked this fairly low. I like tried to think about what movies I remembered and I was like, don't really remember Under Wraps. Kind of remember Horse Sense. And so I stuck it between Horse Sense and The 13th Year because I was like, I think all the movies below that could also be condensed to like 20, 30 minutes, maybe. Like Boy Goes to Farm, resolves, becomes a better person. Mummy gets brought back to life and then restored. And so like, this is like Kids Bowl. That's and then win the bowling. So yeah, it wasn't bad, but and there had good like lessons. I think as a kid, I would have been like, oh, good, the nerdy kids have their time to shine and are just being themselves.
I agree entirely with everything that has already been said. This movie is like solidly middling right now. I have it sitting at 11 out of 15, and basically the four that are below it are four that I'm like, no, I did not really like those four movies, and like this one is fine. Like it's not a bad movie. I understand why I remembered so little of it, despite having watched it a ton and also liking it when I was younger, because it is very much just nothing. I did kind of like the fact that when we first see the dynamic between these kids and the cool kids, they are being mean to the cool kids. Like, they are being more openly antagonistic first. Yes, the cool kids are mean back to them and are meaner, but like, I don't know. There is something about that resonated with me as like a high school, like when I look back on my teenage years, there is definitely a sense of I probably could have had a lot more friends than I did if I wasn't just so like salty and mean, like, I don't know, into my whatever weird teenager identity that I was attached to having at that point in my life, you know? And like, that's definitely part of what is going on with these kids. So I actually kind of disagree with Matt's sense that these kids don't exist. Like, I don't know. They're like, I buy that. I buy the idea that you have these kids that have just constructed this version of an identity that is intentionally countercultural and that they become very, very attached to it to a degree that they kind of look down on everybody else for being like normal, basically. And they start to sort of seed the idea that like things don't really have to be that way. And Alex finds that, you know, when he actually makes an effort to be friends with other people, he can do that and it's fine. And maybe the, you know, normal kids or the cool kids or whatever aren't assholes after all, but then like in the end they are assholes. I don't know, that was like, it like started to go somewhere that I thought was interesting, and then they didn't. So
just to clarify, I will say that I think kids like that exist. Like, I think totally, like, people in high school are like that. I think for me, the acting slash writing in this film, I didn't believe that those kids were real characters. Like, especially the one kid who was like super into the 50s music. Like, he never really seemed like committed to any of these things. It was like he was reading a script. And it just felt to me that, like, it, as much as it is a thing in high school to like sort of put on and like lock into a persona sometimes, it felt like, it felt like paper thin, this sort of character they had built for themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, they're totally the bullies in the first like chunk of this movie. I wrote that in my notes too. I was like, our heroes feel like the bullies because they're just as mean.
To be honest, I kind of like that they were just as mean, because so many times in like movies and things, you have like the nerds that are like kind of helpless, but they had such a like tight knit group there. It was like a very insular kind of thing that they didn't need anybody. And they obviously like had their own routine and they had friends and they were having fun. And so they didn't really feel the need to, I don't know, belong anywhere else, which was, I think, what the movie was trying to tell us was part of the main like conflict. I don't think it did a very good job communicating that necessarily, but the little group of friends was probably one of the better things for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was, even though they were kind of snarky and mean, I think it was nice to not, it was nice to subvert the idea that just the, like, the star athlete would come in and pick on these bowling kids and be rude to them, but like they weren't welcoming to him either. Mm-hmm. And I think that made for a more interesting story where, like, they had to find out that this perfect star athlete wasn't quite as happy because his parents were putting too much pressure on him. And so even though their parents don't seem to care where they ever are, because they could just stay at a diner really late at night or go across the street in the dark to pin a bowling sheet on their friend's door. Like, they have it easy in some ways, too. Again, I don't think the movie really stuck the landing for, but as an adult watching this, I can be like, oh yeah, this is like a realistic childhood relationship, because you never are just getting along with people. You have your core group of friends and then everyone else, you're like, you're not my friend, really. Or at least that's how I was. Maybe I was a mean nerd or a loner or somewhere in between.
Or just in general, though, like the idea that in sort of antagonistic dynamics like that, there are two sides to that relationship. Like, I think that's the thing that I really did like about the, like, the first half of it, was just the idea that, like, it's not just, oh, everybody's so mean to them and that's why, like, they have their out, they're outsiders because everybody is so mean. But, like, I don't know, like, they're they're kind of snarky, too.
I think part of why it misses the mark is also it's sort of inconsistent throughout the movie. Like, yeah, if there was a very clear arc of, like, these people think they're better than you and these people think they're better than you, and then slowly they both learn that, like, oh, no, we have a lot more in common and we can work together and all this stuff. But it kind of, like, ebbs and flows throughout the film. Like, there was one part where I like rewound it like 10 minutes and rewatched part of it, because some of the like other bowling kids, there's a scene where they're really sort of mean and snarky to Todd, and this is like 15-20 minutes after he's already been bowling with them for a little while, and they've been like encouraging him and sort of accepting of him more than Alex had been at this point. And then suddenly they're just like really mean to him in one scene. And I'm like, and I had to go back and go, wait, what happened? What did he do? And it was nothing. They just decided to make them be mean to show that, okay, but we're not real friends yet.
What I also thought was interesting is how not complicated the parents were, like, even more so than a normal DCOM, it felt like. Like, what was going on with the mayors and betting against each other? That was one of the only notes I took. What a weird bet, 40 gallons of cider versus 40 apple pies. Like, who are these men and why are they... Why are they betting their apple products against each other, and parades, and then a middle school I don't know, almost like adults trying to be like, what would a child understand in betting language? Well, food, a name, and a big thing, like a big party. It almost felt like they didn't have anything for the adults to do, really, besides just be in the background because it was about the bowling. They all kind of lingered, talked about their small town shenanigans, and then encouraged their kids. And that was their whole purpose in the whole movie.
Yeah, which I think ties back to the larger sense of this being a, like, it was fine. Like, there was nothing about this movie that I'm like, oh, this was bad. It's just, it has all the trappings of every other DCOM, but simplified in most cases.
For me, the mayor stuff felt a little bit like they were trying to tap into that sort of the dean from Genius, if you remember that character.
From Sari's favorite DCOM.
Yeah, I blocked it out.
But they sort of felt similar to that sort of thing, where they needed this character to have their own story on the side that we could cut back to when we ran out of bowling montages. And I think, for me, the mayor bet sort of worked because that happens in real life. Like, I know for the Super Bowl, the mayor of San Francisco and the mayor of Kansas City, like, had a bet about sending each other food, like seafood versus barbecue ribs and stuff. So that does happen. It didn't ping on me as being weird, other than the fact that, like, yeah, they're across town from each other. They could just drive and get those apple pies.
They can bike. The kids biked to the other town.
Right.
Yeah.
Weird. I didn't know. I don't. This sounds bad. It's like, I don't really know what mayors do in relation to other mayors. Like, I know, like, local governance, but I don't. I guess mayors sometimes place bets. This is the new thing I learned. They become friends with other mayors and are like, you there, I'll send you food if I lose a thing, a sports thing.
I think that's what half of what mayors do.
Yeah. How did you guys feel about the freeze frame and then Alex narration over it? Like, you might wonder how I ended up here.
Oh man, that was the worst part of this movie.
Yes, agreed. It happened so many times. Why did it happen so many times?
How did you feel about it, Sari?
I thought it was really funny, especially when
I'm glad you asked it, because I feel like after you guys were like, ugh, where she was just gonna be like, yeah, and like peter off.
Yeah. No, especially when it really got me in a couple of moments where I was like waiting for something to happen, and then they would like pause it right before I think Delia's ball hit the 7-10 split, and I was like, oh, rats! That freeze frame got me again.
See, for me, it felt like they were using it to draw out the length of the movie a little bit, or explain things that maybe they had poorly written in the script and were like, maybe people won't understand that. We better pause the movie and explain it to them. Mm-hmm. Because for me, the biggest one that irked me was when the mayor and Alex's dad are first like seeing each other in the movie. They clearly have a beef of some sort where they used to be friends or something, and as the baseball game went wrong, they're not friends anymore. Like, you can tell that from what they say to each other. It's not that subtle. But the movie pauses and it's like, every time they're in the same room, they have a problem with each other, and I don't know what's happening.
What's going
and I'm like,
on there?
Yeah, we all could figure that out. You didn't need to tell us that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is why it was unintentional comedic effect for me instead of annoying. It was just like, what a dumb movie. It's just doing its thing.
There's also something about the quality of like early 2000s digital video technology that when they pause it, it just looks like you paused your VCR, because it's a little squiggly. Yeah. And it doesn't look great. And it looks very bad.
Mm-hmm. I could imagine if I wasn't paying close enough attention and was watching this on TV, I'd be like, did something go wrong? Like, did it pause for some reason? But the other effects that I feel like are noteworthy enough to call out are during the party scene at Alex's dad's bowling alley. It just got all wiggly. I don't know how to describe it.
Oh,
you guys,
yeah.
Matt, you actually went to film school. So what would you call that effect? What would you call that keen edit right there?
Windows Movie Maker effects is what I would call that. I didn't really understand why it was happening. And I think that's a lot of the editing choices in this film were just making me sit back and go, huh. They all felt like afterthoughts to me of either this movie's not long enough, how can we make it slightly longer to fit into commercials, or maybe our production design doesn't look great, so how can we obscure this party a little bit? And I think that's what happens, is you apply a weird filter so people don't pay attention to the background, or that you only have 15 actors at this party, or that you couldn't afford actual decorations. I think those are the types of things you add in your like last stretch, like final edits kind of thing, where you're trying to fix a movie that's maybe broken.
That was my sense of it too. It was like, this party is not fun. How do we make it look more fun? Woo, 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 do that, but with the camera.
The beginning of it reminded me of like the shaky camera at Don't Look Under the Bed, when the kids are just walking down the street, like arm in arm.
Yeah.
And the camera was just like, whoa, we're having fun. It's like, you know, I'm not having fun right now.
I got really afraid that was like going to keep happening throughout the whole movie. And it just seemed like they forgot to tell the camera guy that they were going to do it, because he was like, he was running away from them. Like, guys, slow down, please slow down. My favorite moment of the whole movie is when Todd is trying to first sort of get to know these kids a little bit, and he's asking about their music tastes, and they're talking about sort of the 50s swing music they listen to. And then Todd is like, well, why don't you listen to today's hits like Backstreet Boys, Savage Garden, and Aerosmith? And like, that's what like a 40-year-old man decom writer probably wrote. What do kids listen to? This kid, he listens to those three very different musical acts. That's what the most popular kid in high school is definitely listening to.
This week, we are talking about our weird hobbies. Like, these kids had their bowling and being retro and diners, I guess. Those were their hobbies. So what about you guys?
I guess I'll start. I was just a weird kid, so all of my hobbies, I think, were weird. I basically collected everything that you could collect as a person or a child. Rocks. Coins, shells, Pokemon cards, Legos, just like...
It sounds like you
books.
Weren't a collector, you were a hoarder.
Marbles, dice, like, I don't... But I only kept the ones that I liked, but I liked a lot of them. So it wasn't just like a pile of meaningless rocks. I could be like, oh, I like this one because it's shiny. I like this one because it's petrified wood. I like this one because it's a pyrite or something like that. Marbles were a little bit dicier, where it was like, I like these 40 because they're all cat eyes and so they have swirly colors inside. So maybe I was just a hoarder. That was my weird hobby as a child.
Hoarding. I was somewhat similar as a kid, where I also had a lot of weird collections. Like, I collected Beanie Babies and Pokemon cards and Hot Wheels cars, and also a lot of NASCAR paraphernalia, because that's the kid I was. I think the more embarrassing part is that most of that stuff is still at my parents' house, just sitting in their garage.
Yes, me also. To be clear, I have no right whatsoever to tease anybody for being a hoarder. I just saw that opportunity and took it, and then immediately was like, no, actually.
It you.
Really, I'm talking about myself. So just in before any member of my family listens to this podcast and tries to come for me.
I was a weird bowling kid, though.
Really? Is that how you got your 233?
As a kid, my high score was 165. I remember that clearly, because I was in a bowling league when I was like 8.
What?
And would bowl every single weekend. I had my own custom ball.
This is amazing.
I love this.
And I do really enjoy bowling still. I get to do it like once a year, because like a friend will have a birthday party at the bowling alley or something. And then I get to try and show off, which is the main reason I suggested we do the bowling scores for the introductions, is because I was wanted to brag. But now I think my weirdest hobby is probably like model building and painting. But because it's one of those hobbies that I specifically sought out to do for me and doesn't really involve anybody else, and no one else makes me do it, and I don't have to like share it with the world if I don't want. Like, I've had a lot of hobbies that were like music related or different podcasts and all these things, and I realized, I was like, oh, all those hobbies result in me having to give something to other people, so I need a hobby that's just for me. And so that led to weird model painting and building that I very much enjoy, but is sometimes weird, and I have to remind myself of like, oh yeah, no, you're doing a weird thing that not everyone does.
It's a thing that has very little space for external validation to like determine your relationship with it. Like, you can post pictures on Instagram or whatever, but like ultimately the thing is the thing, and it's like you making the thing. I recently started learning how to sew. My mom bought me a sewing machine when I was 15. And again, because my parents also still have a ton of my shit in their house, this sewing machine has been like languishing in my high school bedroom closet for 15 years. And so when I was home over Thanksgiving, we got it out, and like I had my mom teach me how to use it. And like, I've been, you know, making skirts and quilts and all sorts of stuff that like ultimately making things, and it is super time consuming. But then like the end result of that time is, yeah, maybe I will like post a picture of it, but it is a thing that I am doing for entirely self-motivated reasons. It's a little bit less weird, I think, than the kit bashing thing, but a little more basic. So I don't know that it entirely qualifies as a weird hobby, but it is definitely coming from like that same sort of place of like trying to find space to do a thing solely like for me. And also it's kind of cool because it gives me a reason to call my mom. Mom, help me.
I can't think of any hobbies, weird hobbies that I had as a kid. I was kind of just like a basic child, really like nerdy. I read a lot. I watched a lot of TV, and I wasn't allowed to go out a lot. Like, I had overprotective parents. So, you know, nothing super interesting. Before we started the podcast, I was like, I think podcasting is my weirdest hobby. And, you know, you kind of lose that a little bit, and making YouTube videos, because obviously I have a bunch of media friends and friends that I've made through like making videos and podcasting. But every once in a while, like, I'm in an Uber and somebody's like, oh, what do you do? Or what are you in town for? Like, if I'm at a conference, or, well, oh, the Comcast guy was at my house. The cable guy was at my house recently to fix something, and he saw a bunch of my microphones, and he's like, do you sing? And I was like, I podcast. And he was like, whoa, like, he made the weirdest face. I was like, cool, cool, cool. Great, great. Great. So yeah, as an adult, this might be my weirdest hobby in certain spaces and circles. I think in high school, so, you know, what is joining a club if not a weird hobby? I was on the debate team, which isn't like, I guess, super weird, but everybody knows debate team for like mock trials and debating. But I was on the speech and forensic side of it, which means that we just did a bunch of little scenes and acting. Nobody ever knows what forensics was. So I had to be like, no, it's like the acting part of debate. And we also rehearsed, like, I had a debate hour in my schedule. So we rehearsed like outside in the hallways. And a lot of times in like, either it's you and one other person, or you by yourself when you're doing like the speech or the forensics or whatever. So basically you were talking to yourself in the hallways. And so people would be like going to their bathroom break, and I was rehearsing my dramatic scene at the gravestone of my best friend, which was the scene. but I was totally like an alley cat. Like, I didn't care. I owned my weirdness. So that was cool. I think that's it. Oh, as far as collecting things, this was also maybe early 20s. So I was still, you know, early 20s. There was a point where I collected bottles of nail polish. Not on purpose. I think I just got really into nail polish. And then all of a sudden I was like, wow, I own 200 nail polishes. So that was a thing.
This has become part of your identity now.
Right.
That's how I was with DVDs. And that just happened because in college, I got my own money and was like, I want to buy my own DVDs now.
Yes, right.
I went to college with like 12 DVDs. I came back from college with 500 DVDs. And I'm like, oh, that's where all my money went. I wasn't drinking in college or partying. I was buying all of the DVDs that existed.
Incredible.
The high school thing is interesting because it also kind of ties back to the whole, like, I don't know, learning how to have hobbies again as an adult because we've professionalized all of our hobbies.
Correct.
In a like classic millennial move. Uh-huh. But because my like high school thing, I was the president of the multimedia club, which is basically the AV club. Like we did all the, like we ran cameras at assemblies and we edited, we like did made videos for assemblies, basically a lot of stuff for assemblies. but like that was like a thing that I did in high school that was a weird thing about me and had basically nothing to do with what I went to college for, but kind of everything to do with what I do for a living now. So that didn't even stand out to me as a thing until Mari, listening to you describe like your sort of high school club experience, because I was in a bunch of clubs. Most of the clubs I was just in for the sake of putting them on my college applications, because I was that kid. But like the multimedia club was the one thing that I legitimately did out of sincere and earnest interest, and like took an independent study period so I could work on stuff more and whatever. But like it's like now my job. So it doesn't feel like it qualifies as a weird hobby because it's not a hobby because I get paid money to do this.
Yeah, the discussion about high school clubs also reminded me that I was in chess club at one point in my life. Yeah, that was sixth grade, I think. Basically, I was the kid who my parents just let me try whatever I wanted for as short of a period of time as I wanted. So I did wrestling and track and football and baseball and basketball. Probably more things that I'm already forgetting because I would quit some of these things when I got bored and be like, eh, sure, football now. That seems fine. And so I, jack of all trades, master of none is exactly what I was, except for in high school, I fell into show choir and doing music stuff. And that's actually what I stuck with all 4 years of high school was show choir. So that is a weird thing that I forget I did sometimes.
Yeah, this is also reminding me of my high school. I didn't like people like you, Matt. So I did not join teams, but I did have a lot of weird activities where I was like, Dad, can you fund me? I wanted to learn how to whittle at some point. So I like grabbed a stick from our backyard and a pocket knife and tried to whittle. And would make, that's like the best example I can
Sari,
think of.
That's
but
amazing. I feel like this is an untapped resource. I don't know what the future of this information is, but I feel as though we have to do something with this information. Sari learned how to whittle.
Yeah. But it was a lot of like very small one-off things like that, where it was an activity I could do by myself. So I learned how to jump on a pogo stick. I learned how to ride a unicycle. So basically like I did all these weird skill-based things. Also became a master of none, but could passably do these things. And then joined theater because my friend, who is the president of that club, bullied me into it, not to act, but to build sets, because she's like, Sari, you just make all these things for fun and to no end. So how about you make things with a purpose? But I'm sure she said it much nicer and was like, you can just like use power tools and build sets. And so that's what I did, was like monopolize my garage and be like, well, we need a microphone now, or we need a tree with candy hanging off of it. How am I going to do that? And then just do that for hours and hours and hours in my spare time.
Shout out to our parents who taught us how to whittle and let us join clubs and funded field trips. I went to Harvard with my debate team for a competition once. And I think listening just now, it clicked in my head that my mom was like, okay, I guess I'll work some overtime so she could send me on this vacation. Oh, well, not vacation, on this like school trip or whatever. And now I'm like, damn, my mom was the MVP. She worked extra hours for that. So yay parents who support kids' hobbies, weird hobbies, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yes.
Yes.
Support their kids in hobbies that they really don't understand.
Correct.
Yeah.
There's so many things that now as an adult who has to spend his own money, mm-hmm. that I look back on when I was a kid, whether it was like toys I had or trips I went on or hobbies like this, that I look back and go, wow, I cost my parents so much extra money on top of just keeping him alive that I'm like, wow, good job, Mom.
That was the experience the first time I went to Disney World as an adult and I had to go to the ticket booth first. And they were like, 100 of your dollars, please. And I was like, excuse you. My mother brought me here every summer.
And now it is time to talk about the lessons that we learned from Alley Cat's strike.
I learned that the coolest trophy that everyone's going to fight over for decades has an apple on top, and an apple kind of looks like a bowling ball.
I learned that sometimes you love something, but that something doesn't make you money, so you should get a real estate license.
I learned that it's not about how good you are at sports, but how well-dressed you are when you're playing those sports that matters.
And I learned that if you have a business that's failing, all you have to do is throw a party, and your business is fixed. And now it is time for Sari to guess the plot of the next movie. Next time on Cooler Than Homework, we are watching Rip Girls.
After I'm like demoralized after how far off I was with Alley Cat Strike, I feel like I've lost my touch. Uh-huh. And by my touch, I mean whatever wild guesses that were getting more accurate. With that caveat in place to prevent myself from future embarrassment, Riptides... makes
rip
me think
girls.
There you go. Rip Girls makes you think of Riptides, which are so like ocean related things. So it's a beach movie. And so Johnny Tsunami was surfing. So I'm guessing this girl is like a lifeguard, maybe. I think I'm circling back to my original guess for one movie or another. It's like a girl. Okay, so it's a teenage girl. It's always a teenager who's a lifeguard on the beach. And for some reason, there are a lot of people swimming. And there's like a shark that goes in the water at some point, and people are like, wow, sharks. Or they're just afraid of it. Maybe there's like, oh, okay. Take it back. There's a girl who's a lifeguard on a beach. She loves it. Usually teenagers don't like their jobs as lifeguards because one, you have to protect other people's lives. Two, you have to sit in the hot sun all day and you don't get a swim. But her name is Caroline, loves it. But then the town gossip magazine says that there are shark-infested waters at the beach. And so what's usually a very fun summer activity, she has like her parent friends and her child friends and like a group of girls that always comes to, I don't know, like play beach volleyball maybe. So she's like indirectly related to them. Where she sees them playing beach volleyball and she's like, you go. And they're like, you guard. And then they all leave. And so then she has to like forge a local campaign to fight against the shark misinformation and get her beach back. Tagline?
Oh, man. Sari, I cannot find a tagline for this movie. This is your phone a friend. And instead of giving you a tagline, since I can't find one, I'm just going to tell you that Johnny Tsunami is not a surfing movie. It's a snowboarding movie. And that's your phone a friend.
That makes me think that this might be a surfing movie.
Wow.
And maybe Caroline, instead of being a lifeguard, is in fact a surfer with big dreams. And I don't know, she like wins a surfing competition or something. That's like how these things go. It's a bowling movie, they bowl. It's a surfing movie, she surfs. And she has a girl gang of surfers. And the boys are mean to her. And then she's like, no, girls can surf too. And then she wins a gold medal given to her by Johnny Tsunami's grandpa.
Nailed it. That was perfect. That's exactly what the movie's about.
Well, join us next time to find out how close that is to the plot of Rip Girls. If you are enjoying this podcast, please tell your friends, rate and review it, all that good stuff. We would love to hear your thoughts about Alley Cat Strike. There will be a post dedicated to this episode, or you can find us on Twitter at DCOM Squad. I am at Sweeney Says.
I am at Matthew Gatos.
You can find me at My Name is Madines.
And I am at C.E. Riley.
This podcast is a Snark Squad production, edited by me, transcribed by Mari, and our theme music is by Stefan Chin.